Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tougher, even if they don't, today is Wednesday, May the 29th, 2025. This is episode 3679. And since it is Thursday, it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I've got a great lineup for you, including something that I'm hoping to be able to do more of, and I've already got another such example set for next week. This one we have two today of, because the third one I played last week. You'll understand in a moment. But here's what we're going to talk about today. First of all, we have Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams leading off, as we usually do, from the Ron Paul Liberty Highlights for the week. Their topic is, and this is in my words, paraphrasing what they have to say, Trump needs to close the books on Biden's war. And of course, we're talking about the Russian-Ukraine conflict. This is not our problem, except that we made it our problem. And the day that we stop making it our problem, there will be actual peace negotiations. And so I'll let Dr. Paul and Dan talk to you about that. Then I got like a twofer, as I was saying. So last week, we got an answer from Ben Falk on improving native plants and things like that to restore native wildlife on a property. I sent that question to Jeff Lawton, Nick Ferguson, and Ben Falk. We played Ben Falk's answer to it last week. This week, we're going to play Jeff and Nick's. A lot of times when we do this with multiple experts chiming in on the same thing, you get very similar answers. We got three completely different and totally correct answers here. And I find that to be really useful for people to hear different approaches by great permaculturists and regenerative agriculture people to the same problem and have different approaches and yield exceptional results. So that's what we'll be doing there. When we get to that one, I'll play Nick and Jeff back to back after the intro to it. Then Doc Bones is going to talk about LASIK eye surgery and PRK eye surgery, the trade-offs should you have eye surgery at all. That's something a lot of people are actually really interested in right now. It's gotten to be very affordable, and if you wear glasses, you know, if you're old enough like me, that maybe you weren't there when they were making them brand new, but you watched reruns of The Twilight Zone when you were a kid. You know, everybody remembers the very famous episode where the guy, the nuclear war comes, and all this guy wants to do is read. And he's down in a basement or something like that, and he comes up after the war, and there's no one there, but everything's still standing, and there's bookstores, and he's like, there's finally time to read, and he breaks his glasses, and he can't see without them. Hey, yeah, like that kind of mindset, like if something really goes wrong, and I can't see, and something happens to whatever corrective lenses I have, you know, that's a problem, but if I have eye surgery and it's botched, then that's also a problem. Or if it fades over time, like there's a lot of reasons you may not want to do it, or take the risk, or maybe you do. Doc Bones will help walk us through all of that. Matt Sersley is going to talk about the ins and outs of business meal deductions. Remember always when you get an answer from Matt, he's going to give you an answer like a lawyer, which means to the letter of the law. And there's a good reason to know that that I won't say right now. Okay? And then Mike Melito will talk about red dots for AKs. When I got this question, I rolled my eyes and made a groan. Thinking that's really not what the AK platform is designed for. Let's see what Mike has to say about that. And then I'll have my anchor segment. And this is kind of a pattern I've been on X lately, because X is where I see the most wailing and gnashing of teeth about how disappointed the true believers of the MAGA cult are in Trump. You know, Elon went out and found all this waste, and son of a bitch, the Republicans in the Senate and the House have no interest in actually cutting it. They all wailed against it, like, this is crazy, we're giving $28 million for a transsexual opera in Ireland, we need to get rid of it, but they won't vote to get rid of it. I mean, there's no support for it, and everybody's upset, and then there's 100 other things. 100 other things. We should go to the gold standard. That'll fix everything. No, you stupid ass. We need Ripple. That's not happening either. Like, we need to audit the gold at Fort Knox. To what end? No one knows, right? Like, all this bitching, basically, is the way that I would phrase it. Just absolute positive bitching about the way things should be. Mostly, the people saying the way things should be, I completely agree with their opinion about the way things should be, or even if I don't completely agree, I mostly agree. And if we could get halfway to what everybody's saying, that would be progress. But you know what I'm going to tell you, right? It's not going to happen. We're going to rein in spending. No, we're not. There's one plan right now. One plan and one plan only. Grow the economy while we devalue the dollar to balance the ends. Is that a good plan? You know, good is neutral. Good is neutral in this. There is no good. There only is. And that's what my segment is today. It's called Why We Have to Change Our Entire Mindset from What Should Be to What Is Going to Be. Because I believe we stand on the precipice right now of one of the greatest opportunities in a century or more for those who will capitalize on it. And all I get when I say that is whiny, bitchy shit. I just did a post about this where I'm like, you 30-somethings, you young 30-somethings that are crying about how hard it is, I should kick you in the nuts. I would kill to have 20 years, 25 years of my life back right now to capitalize on what's happening right now. And what did I get? How am I supposed to capitalize? I'm a young guy with two children. There's nothing I can do. You know what? I'm not even going to try to help that person. I don't want to talk to that person. I don't want to spend a single verbal calorie on that person because they're not ready yet. Remember the old Kung Fu thing where the kid goes to the master and he wants to be taught, and the kid holds out the cup for him to pour the tea, and the master keeps pouring the tea and pouring the tea and pouring the tea and pouring the tea, and then it starts overflowing, and the student gets all upset, and the master says, "You need to leave. You are like this cup. You are too full. You must be empty if you are to learn." Well, I don't know if you need to be empty, but you do need to be open. People that aren't open right now are going to fulfill a horrible self-fulfilling prophecy. They're going to impoverish themselves at a time that future generations will look back on and think, that would have been a great time to be young. Look at all the opportunity. Every generation shall blame the one before. That will be the angle we come at when we get to it today. With that, I'm pre-recording this, so I don't know the results. I'm assuming by the time you're hearing this that the ChatGPT course is full because we were so over pre-registered, but we'll be going forward with that soon. That's going to be something that people really need to learn. So even if you didn't get into the first round, I want to encourage you to not turn away from artificial intelligence, to leverage that tool, much as I told you to leverage the asset that is Bitcoin many, many years ago. Because, we cannot stay focused on what should be. We need to be real about what is. Before we get started, real quick, let me just remind you guys that if you like the show and you want to help support me, a really super easy way to do that is to just do your online shopping starting where? tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Also remind you, pick up a copy of my book if you haven't done so already, Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life. And if you know young people that could use a good tongue lashing like I just gave as set up for the show, get them a copy of this book. They may not listen to the show, but they might read that book, and they might even learn something. It's funny what happens when you hand somebody a book. The book continues to sell really well. One thing I will ask you guys again, though, I think we have about 39 reviews so far. We've sold almost 2,000 books. If we could get some more reviews, that would be really helpful. So if you've started reading the book and you're actually enjoying it, please consider getting by Amazon and doing a review for us. It really helps a lot. With that, let's go ahead, drop in, and hear our first segment from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams. Trump needs to close the books on Biden's war.
But President Trump has expressed some frustration over the weekend, and you can see it now coming. He's done everything he's been told by his advisors. Unfortunately, the ones he listens to aren't the right ones, and it's not working. He keeps doing the same thing, and he's not getting a different outcome. So he was, over the weekend, he was interviewed, and we actually have that clip that we should listen to. They asked about President Putin. There had been an increase in drone attacks on both sides, and you might want to grab that earpiece, Dr. Paul. Let's go ahead and watch that clip of President Trump expressing.
I'm not happy with what Putin's doing. He's killing a lot of people, and I don't know what the hell happened to Putin. I've known him a long time, always gotten along with him, but he's sending rockets into cities and killing people, and I don't like it at all, okay? We're in the middle of talking, and he's shooting rockets into Kiev and other cities. I don't like it at all.
Mr. President, what do you want to do about that?
I'm surprised. I'm very surprised. We'll see what we're going to do. What am I going to tell you?
Well,
You're the fake news, aren't you? You're totally fake. All right, any other questions? I don't like what Putin is doing, not even a little bit. He's killing people. And something happened to this guy, and I don't like it.
Well, there's lots of things I don't like, I'll tell you. And it's the denial, total denial by establishment Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, neocons are the worst. And that is no sense of responsibility for their contribution to this ordeal that we're all going to live through. And they just claim that it's all one-sided fault. At the same time, people know that our dollars, our money, and our weapons have stirred up a lot of problem. And I'll bet you would probably agree to a point, and it really hasn't slowed up all that much, all the money and weapons we were sending.
No, and there may be some new stuff coming down the pipe if Trump's new turn now. He was last week, Putin was fine, we're getting progress. Now he's gone crazy, and I don't like him anymore. We're not friends anymore. We're not best buddies anymore. And this is Sky News. These missiles that went into Kiev killed at least 12 people. Now, that's a tragedy. That's terrible. But 12 people is not a lot of people in a war. And in fact, go to that next clip for some perspective. Israel strikes hit school turned shelter in Gaza, killing at least 36. That's a lot of people, and they're killing more than 100 a day. He's not mentioned anything about Netanyahu killing a lot of people. But anyway, back to this, Dr. Paul. He's saying Putin is launching drones into Ukraine for no reason whatsoever. Well, let's go to the Telegraph, which is an extremely anti-Russia newspaper in the UK. And they reported just before the Russians launched these strikes, Putin's helicopter fended off drone attack. So the Ukrainians, and the big question is, where did they get the intel? They apparently, Dr. Paul, launched drones toward Putin's helicopter when Putin went to Kursk. So that would be number one, why they were angry. Now, number two, this is our good friend Larry Johnson. He put out something, and we have it up on the RPI website, too. Larry Johnson is responding to Trump's outburst, saying, gee, why would Putin order massive strikes on Ukraine on May 24th and 25th? No reason whatsoever. And Larry Johnson says, it appears that no one briefed Trump on what Ukraine did starting May 19th. Between May 19th and May 25th, Ukraine conducted a significant escalation in its drone campaign against Russia, launching over 700 drones across various regions. Now go to the next one. Last one, Dr. Paul, because I think this is the important bit of context. Just imagine how Donald Trump would react if Mexican drug cartels launched 700 attack drones into the U.S. We all know the answer. The U.S. would be bombing Mexico as we speak. Trump's failure to acknowledge the precipitating actions of Ukraine is a reminder that this man is driven by emotion, not thought or reason. And I think that's important because it's just what you said a minute ago. They never think about what caused this, you know, 2014, all these other things. The only is the reaction. So,
all right, so next up, this is our twofer. I'm going to play Nick Ferguson's answer first. And the only reason I'm going to do that, because I think these answers are somewhat different and equally good. I mean, these are two experts. I think but Nick does a better job of introducing the question. So that'll give you a better frame of reference as to what they're actually answering. And there'll be no break in this. I'll start the run. You'll hear Nick's answer, and then it'll go right into Jeff's, and then I'll be back with you.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with an expert counsel answer for R2 on wildlife habitat in Wyoming. And his question is, what native trees and shrubs do you recommend for wildlife habitat, and how should planting sites be prepared? I'm going to give one little quick thing before I get into the details. The native trees and shrubs. So I am a strong and firm believer in the fact that all plants on this planet are native to the planet Earth. So I'm going to give you some native plants. I'm also going to give you a couple non-natives that I think will do fantastically for you. So let's get into the details. And you had a lot of details, so I have tried to make it kind of like bullet points for the listeners. This family is planning to move from Washington State to rural Wyoming within the next 2 years. Congratulations, Walking to Freedom. Looking for regenerative land in, I'm not going to give the area, USDA Zone 4B in Wyoming. Targeting hilly, dry terrain with limited year-round water, ideal property size 3 to 40 acres. Restore habitat for mule deer, white-tailed deer, pronghorn, upland birds, and pollinators. Possible rotational grazing later, but focus now is wildlife first. You hope to discourage prairie rattlesnakes through smart vegetation and design. And let's see, you want to plant native, drought-tolerant, cold-hardy species requiring low maintenance. Looking for plants that offer food, shade, and cover while improving soil health and moisture retention. And you're looking for site prep advice on slopes, including soil amendments, mulching, erosion control, water retention, and plant spacing. Like I said, that was the bullet points. Cool, man. Okay, first off, I might actually end up in the area on a consulting tour and visiting a friend later this year. I'm going to be around the Yellowstone area. Might be an opportunity for a consult if that's interesting for you. Okay, let's get into the natives. Buffalo berry, that's Shepherdia argentea. Chokeberry, that's Prunus virginiana. Serviceberry, that's Amelianchier alnifolia. Woods rose, that's Rosa woodsii. Big sagebrush, that's Artemisia tridentata, I think. Rocky Mountain juniper is Juniperus scopulorum. I think I'm getting all of those right. Double check me on those, please. Let's kind of go through those. There's quite a few nitrogen fixers. Most of these are drought tolerant. The buffalo berry is. Produces berries for birds and bears, great for hedgerows, soil improvement. The choke cherry, excellent pollinator plant. It'll feed deer and birds, works well on slopes and in draws. Serviceberry is great. It's basically like a low drama, low needs blueberry. Edible berries, and wildlife loves it. Excellent nectar source for pollinators, dense cover for nesting birds, lots of stuff like this. The woods rose, it's tough, it's a native shrub, rose hips, it's going to help stabilize slopes, prevent erosion. Big sagebrush, that's a keystone species for pronghorn habitat. It's great winter forage, and it's cover for upland birds. Very drought tolerant, long-lived. Juniper, same kinds of things. Cover, berries for birds, windbreak, shelter belt. It's going to stabilize soils. If you plant the juniper really dense, you are going to end up with a little bit of rattlesnake habitat. Any of the stuff that you're doing here to cover the ground and make thickets is going to produce rodent habitat. And wherever there's rodent habitat, you're going to have snake habitat. It's going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to at the same time increase your habitat and the health of that ecosystem without increasing the snake population. It's just going to happen. So you're just going to have to kind of deal with it. Couple things that are non-native but useful. Siberian pea shrub, that's Carragona arborescens, and white mulberry. I know I am the mulberry king. Morris alba. Now, I would actually suggest that you go with the Tatarica variety. It is going to be a Siberian cultivar that is adapted to very cold weather. Both of them, cold hardy, drought tolerant. The pea shrub is going to be a nitrogen fixer, high protein browse for deer. It's dense cover, great windbreak. The mulberry, excellent, excellent browse and shade. It's going to be high protein content for any of those herbivores. The fruit's going to feed birds, pollinators, mammals. It's going to establish fast. It's fantastic. Both of those are going to be rock stars, although they are not native. So if you're really, really adamant about only natives, then don't use those. If you're like me and you say, listen, I can use non-natives and use them judiciously and wisely And if my ultimate goal is to end up with an only native habitat, then you can utilize these really hardy, great plants that do well in that environment and then success them out of the system with chop and drop when you get better things growing in there. Site preparation, planting tips. Start with a water plan. Look for the natural low points, swales, draws, anywhere that water is going to accumulate. And then you want to make sure that you are catching and slowing that down. You're going to end up with water events where you will not want a single drop of that water leaving your property, if at all possible. So think about check dams on your slopes. Put in some basins, put in swales. If you're just out there and it's just you and a shovel and a stiff-tined rake, even something as simple as going mostly on contour, you don't have to get super, you know, crazy about this, but if you stay as close to contour as you can, just rake gravel up into a little bit of a ditch and a berm. Anything like that that you can do is going to help. Anything that you can bring in, like mulch or manure, is going to really, really help this system. If you get mulch, if you get manure, put the manure down, cover it with mulch, and you can even cover all of that with rocks. And that is going to help hold as much moisture in there as possible. It's basically going to make a pocket. And if you pile up a whole bunch of rocks on top of that, it's going to stay cooler and more moist. And then that's going to be like little fertile moisture pockets that these roots can kind of push into and utilize. Try and stay away from your synthetic fertilizers. Planting your stuff. Keep your shrubs 4 to 8 feet apart, trees 12 to 20 feet apart. You're probably actually, those are going to be your like eventual spacings. So I would strongly consider putting them in clumps. So put 5 to 6, maybe even as many as 10 or 12 in an area that's about 8 foot in a circle. And that gives you the opportunity to select for the best genetics right there. I'm kind of out of time here. An on-site consult would mean I could give you a lot more actionable and site-specific answers, but that should really help you out with a good jumping-off point. For those of you hearing about my Great American Consulting Tours coming up this year, send me your emails with consulting in the subject line to nick@homegrownliberty.com, and let's get your homesteads optimized and rolling with some great designs and plans for the future. I'm Nick Ferguson with Homegrown Liberty. Do good things.
Hi, Jeff Lawton here, coming to you from Australia. And we've got an inquiry here about doing a regen project on 3 to 40 acres. What they really want is to get wildlife back in and regenerate the land before then possibly move into cell grazing. So they want to see the mule deer and the pronghorn and whatever, and lots of like native wildlife coming back. And they want to know how to rework the land. Well, if you were doing it on an economy, all you'd need is to chisel plow on contour. You wouldn't have to put swales in if you didn't want to, but you want to relieve compaction and chisel plow on contour. So that's a pretty simple tractor job, and you're deep ripping around the landscape so water infiltrates quickly. Now, you could improve that again by putting in compost tea. So you can chisel plow and then compost tea straight into the rip lines. Got to be good compost tea with beneficial soil organisms. That'll kick things along even faster. And you could seed into it as well. Now, you can seed into it and get beneficial different types of pasture grasses and wildflower mixes, all sorts going into that rip line. But what you want to do after that is move in and put your trees in. Now, you could put swales in. I'm not the last one to say you couldn't put swales in, but you want to pick the spots to put your swales. Depends how much investment you want to do. They're not too expensive to do swales. They do really do hold a lot more water than just rip lines. And you can still rip line in between, chisel plow on contour. I wouldn't bother going for the yeoman's plow and more expensive kit. You just don't need it, really. A chisel plow is the same as a yeoman's plow. A yeoman's plow is just a bit more refined. But a chisel plow does the same thing. You can also use an aerator, which is a drum, tow drum machine with like kind of spade. Instead of spikes, it's got kind of spades, and it leaves kind of little spade cuts, which don't give you long lines, which is some advantage because it doesn't rip through all your beneficial fungal threads. You can also have a double drum aerator, and you can offset them so it doesn't just spade a little bit, it rips and tears a fraction. So all of these things are all about decompaction quickly with machinery on contour, right? And then one stage further is get the compost tea in there with beneficial soil organisms into those rip lines as you do it or immediately after, and then seed into it. You can do that as you do it as well. You can put compost tea and the beneficial seed in there, and that's a recovery system. You need the extra seed with different depths of roots and diversity, so those beneficial soil organisms got something to interact with because they need to have roots to interact with, and that's all you're going to have to start with en masse. Then your trees go in the rip lines, and you really got to look at it this way. You've got to put pioneer trees in and support species trees and long-term canopy. So you've really got an assembly of fast-growing pasture herbaceous plants going in. Then you've got pioneer trees. They're really hardy. And then you've got support species that help support the long-term assembly that's going to come through. They're all getting slower and slower and slower, but more and more long-term. So fastest is your pasture grasses and your herbs. Then the next quickest is your pioneers. Then pretty quick, but not as quick, are your support species. And then the real long-term, in for the long haul, are the canopies. Now, you can do this with native species, of course, but often the damage is a lot more severe than native species can easily handle. So there's, I don't see, and it's just me, don't take me too seriously, it's up to you, but we've proven this, and many places we've proven this, using hard-working immigrant species to make assemblies that pioneer the landscape and then cycle out seems to be no problem at all because they're fast carbon pathways. Then your support species, a lot of those can be native, but also quite a lot can be hard-working immigrants. And then in the end, even some of the canopy can be hard-working immigrants. Now, I wouldn't say it's more than 5 to 10% in the end. And what you end up with is not totally endemic, or let's go, not even endemic, but provincial. The purist wants provincial species that exactly from that landscape. What you end up with is a novel ecosystem. Now, the novel ecosystems, when they're well-documented, like Fred Pierce, who wrote the book, The New Wild, Invasive Species, The Saviors of Earth, he documented many places where this has happened haphazardly or accidentally, or nowadays even intentionally with the new speed of recovery we need. There's actually more diversity. There's more wildlife in the novel ecosystem forests that are inevitably going to be most of the forests on Earth, because we've destroyed most of the forests on Earth, and they're not going to come back as a purist endemic or provincial forest. They're going to come back as a novel ecosystem, a bit like our communities. There's not many true native communities out there anymore. The whole world is a mixture of native people mixed with hard-working immigrants. And it's kind of funky. We've got a more diverse diet. We've got more diverse culture. We've got more interesting things going on. It's the same in the ecosystems. That's how you've got to think about it. And it's cheaper to do. Using hard-working immigrants is much cheaper than using local people or local plants. So local plants that pioneer the herbaceous layer in the pasture with hard-working immigrants. Pioneers of local species where they're appropriate and hard-working immigrants together get the job done better. The support species are, again, a mixture of native and non-native. Native, and you could call them invasive, but I'd like to call them hard-working immigrants that come in and stack carbon well and support our long-term canopy, which itself has a small percentage, not too many, but enough novel ecosystem components that are not native. They're not necessarily invasive because they're supportive of local species. They become part of the habitat, and sometimes they're actually dependent. Our native species are dependent on non-native species. Imagine that. How could that happen? Well, that's how it is. There are lots of examples of that worldwide, and that is the new science that we're recording. Hope this helps. Hope it's not too controversial for you, but I'm sure you're going to hear a lot more of this type of talk as we go forward into potentially an extremely abundant future that we know is possible.
Okay, so exactly as I said, two totally different approaches to the same problem. Two completely valid approaches to the same problem. And with the two approaches, you might actually come to a conclusion that combining elements of both might be a great way forward. A lot of the plantings that Nick recommended could go quite well with the basic plow on contour design enhancement with compost tea that Jeff Lawton is recommending. So I think that this is a fantastic example of what happens when we have two different people that are informed comment on the same thing. Priming the pump for next Thursday's show, we're going to have a segment on GPS fencing for sheep. So I sent this to Nicole, and I also sent it to Ryan Steva. And we're going to have both of them, without knowing each other's answers, just like this was, answer that question. I think that'll be really cool. Moving on, though, for what do we got on the deck this week? What about eye surgery? I got to say, this is something that before I learned the true reason for my blindness in my left eye, I had contemplated. I wouldn't do any of these because there's nothing that will fix my left eye, so I damn sure ain't having the minor astigmatism of my right eye corrected with surgery that could go wrong because I don't have a backup, right? Two is one and one is none. I got one. If I lose it, I got none, yeah? But I understand for a lot of people that have, you know, vision issues, and wearing glasses is not a huge, laborious thing, but it is an issue. I mean, there's been times like I drove somewhere and I took my prescription sunglasses and we were supposed to come home and I thought I had an extra pair of glasses in the glove box, but it turned out I took them out of there because that's why they were there in the first place, so there'd be an extra pair, and now it's getting dark and I have to drive home in the dark with sunglasses. No, it's not good. And driving with no glasses, worse. So there are issues, or there was one time I went hunting. I went up in a tree. It was the late fall. The leaf litter was about 18 inches deep on the ground. When I took my head net off, was archery hunting, my glasses went in a pinwheel all the way down to the forest floor. I was about 22 foot up. When I got down, I spent about an hour, and it was almost dark. You know, I was going home for the night. Spent like 40 minutes like digging in the leaves trying to find my, never found them. And those are reasons that, like, if you can come off of your need for lenses, you might do that, right? Or contact lenses have their whole level of maintenance that has to be done and what have you, and they don't work for everybody. So there are several forms of laser eye surgery. The best known one is LASIK. There's also something called PRK, and there's some other options as well. Well, we have a question about this for Doc Bones now.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week's question for the Expert Council comes from Spencer, who writes, actually, he asks a number of questions. One, between LASIK and PRK, which is better in terms of durability and fewer long-term dependencies? Two, considering possible instability of the future, is it smarter to keep a stable prescription and rely on physical glasses that I can control? And three, what would the expert counsel say about the risk versus reward in both everyday and worst-case scenarios? Spencer goes on to say that I'm considering corrective eye surgery and trying to weigh the pros and cons of LASIK versus PRK. Some people report excellent outcomes while others worry about long-term complications or needing prescription updates 5 to 10 years later. My prescription hasn't changed in over a decade, and the idea of not relying on glasses or contacts is appealing, especially from a tactical standpoint. However, I also think about more extreme scenarios like a societal or global trade collapse, where access to prescription lenses or follow-up care could become difficult or impossible. In that kind of situation, keeping my current stable vision with glasses might actually be safer long-term. Spencer, corrective eye surgery is actually an excellent idea, much more so for the far-thinking but nearsighted preparedness-minded person. The last thing you want is for the you-know-what to hit the fan and not be able to see 6 feet in front of you. Now let's talk about your options. You mentioned LASIK, LASIK, and PRK, PRK. LASIK stands for laser-assisted in situ keratomalusis, and PRK stands for photorefractive keratectomy. Both PRK and LASIK are procedures that use a laser to change the shape of your cornea, the outmost layer of your eyeball that covers a colored part of your eye. And it's used to fix fuzzy vision. That's because if your cornea is misshapen, it can't bring light to your eye properly. So what happens during PRK and LASIK? Before either procedure, numbing eye drops are used so you'll feel no pain during the surgery. So it's not a painful procedure, either one of them, Spencer. During LASIK, a surgeon flips open a small layer of your cornea, and they then use a laser to resculpt specific areas inside your cornea that were previously mapped, fixing the spots that cause your vision troubles. Then they put the flap back on top to cover the treated area. In PRK surgery, a flap isn't created. Instead, the laser gets to work directly on the surface of your cornea and reshapes the areas in question. A bandage is then placed to protect the surface of your cornea as it heals. PRK and LASIK surgeries are both outpatient procedures and typically take just about 10 to 15 minutes for the whole thing. Both are known to be some of the safest and most effective surgical procedures around. You can expect vision no worse than 20/40 afterwards, and some people end up with 20/15 vision, actually better than perfect vision. But you, Spencer, want to know the difference between the two. Perhaps the biggest advantage of LASIK over PRK is the quick recovery time. It's common for people who have LASIK to see well the day after surgery. They typically can go to work, drive, and go about their day without missing a beat. With LASIK, all that needs to heal is the edge around the flap. It doesn't take long at all for any discomfort to fade and for your vision to clear. Now, the disadvantages of LASIK, well, not everyone's a good candidate. Your cornea needs to be thick enough to make the flap and correct your vision prescription. A high prescription and a thin cornea means you might not get a good result. Now, one of the most common complaints with LASIK is that people may experience dry eyes following the procedure. If you already have problems with dry eyes, well, it might get worse. And for highly active people, such as those who participate in contact sports, LASIK may not be the right choice. So if you're a boxer, don't get LASIK, or at least wait a good while after the procedure before entering the ring. Let's talk about the advantages of PRK. PRK is an option for people who aren't good candidates for LASIK because there's no flap to worry about. It's actually a safe choice for athletes in contact sports. No flap also means it's an option for people whose corneas are on the thin side. It also can be a better option if you experience dry eyes. After the initial healing period, anyone who has PRK is less likely to rely on artificial tears to keep their eyes moist than those who have LASIK. The main drawback of PRK is that you don't get that immediate gratification of improved vision. It's more of a slow build-up to improved eyesight. In the first few days after PRK, you may have a lot of irritation because you have essentially an open wound on your cornea. It can be a few weeks before people clear up their vision fully. But remember, your chances of correcting your vision are still the same as LASIK. It just takes a longer road to get there. I should say that most people that have the choice between the two will choose LASIK. Bottom line, both PRK and LASIK are safe procedures that can help improve vision. In most cases, you'll no longer need glasses or contacts at all. Now, despite that, some people are reluctant to get it done. Those people need spare eyeglasses in their storage and at least several pairs. Get a dozen pair of eyeglasses in your current prescription and see what happens. The only problem is that your eyesight is going to change with time. Now, that happens also with LASIK, and I can tell you personally, I was blind as a bat until I underwent one of the first LASIK procedures in the country over 30 years ago. Now I have the eyes of an eagle, a very old eagle, but still. It is true your vision does worsen as time goes on, even with these procedures, but not any faster than it would have. You're starting off with a huge improvement that will help you succeed, even if everything else fails. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook. And get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
Hey, that's all good and well. I'm still not doing it again. I mean, when you have one good eye And if something goes wrong, you have no good eye. Yeah, I'm not doing that. I'll stick to glasses. Thanks. If there was something they could do for my my blind eye, I'd risk that. I got very little loose there. Anyway, moving on. Let's now talk about something that, like, I literally groaned and rolled my eyes when I read the question, putting a red dot on an AK-47, but I thought, what the heck? I'll send it over to Mike anyway, and haven't listened to his response yet, so let's listen to it together and see. Does he groan and roll his eyes, or does he just come up with a solution, or a combination of both?
What is going on, TSP? Michael Melito here, blessed to have another segment for you. You got gun questions, I got gun answers. Today's question is going to be about mounting a red dot on an AK. Now, let me start off by saying I really like the AK. I used one for a time over in the sandbox. They are a great weapon. That said, there's no real great way to mount an optic. Not really the fault of Mr. Kalashnikov when he designed this, running optics on infantry rifles, infantry submachine guns. That wasn't really a thing. And unlike the AR, which was easily adapted to take optics with a good solid mount via a flat top upper, there's really no good way to do it on an AK. I know it can be done. I know there's the side mount, I know there's the gas block, but they're all, let's say, suboptimal options. On the specifics of today's question, this one's from Robert. He says, what budget and mid-tier red dot optic would you recommend for a gas tube mount on an AK-47? And he goes on with some details. But here's the thing about the gas tube mount. It can be done. But the gas block, it gets hot, right? So the number one that I'm going to recommend to you is my number one recommendation for a red dot sight that I trust my life to. I'm blessed to have a few of these. It's the Trigicon RMR dual illuminated. Tritium and fiber optic. Trigicon RMR dual illuminated, tritium and fiber optic. No batteries, no electronics. It works via radiation and ambient light via fiber optic cable. I'm sure you could get one hot enough to destroy it, but it's for a defensive carbine, like something you're going to trust your life to. That is going to be my number one recommendation. You said mid-tier. They're not crazy expensive. They're not budget. You can certainly spend more, but that's going to be my number one recommendation if it's a fighting carbine or defensive carbine, or however you want to quantify that. Now, if it's just for fun, I would look at a Hollow Sun 403 series. They're made in China. I have to admit, they're decent optics. Just for Chinese optics, they're like decent optics. They're a fraction of the cost. Looking on Amazon right now, they're sub $200. The Hollow Sun 403C. A bunch of different models. This is the opposite of what I told you when I did last week's segment on optics for an AR, where you want that high height over bore because an AR has a buffer tube. An AK does not. One of the things I like about an AK, it's got a classic stock and it handles more like a classic rifle. That said, you don't want the high mount, especially for the gas tube. You want a low mount, so make sure you get the low mount, the proper mount. You probably already know that, but I'm just throwing that out there. But that 403C, it does take batteries, but it is also solar backup. I break a lot of stuff. I break a lot of optics. I have yet to break one of those. Now, without getting too specific in his email, he mentioned he wanted a 30mm tube. Second optic I mentioned was closer to that. The first one and the last one I'm going to recommend are not. However, I'm not going to say you don't want what you think you want, but consider this. Pistol, you talked about being able to take the recoil and the heat on the AK. Pistol red dots are meant to be slammed. If you think about G-force, that slide goes from zero to really fast, really quick, and it stops abruptly, and it slams forward and stops abruptly again. The amount of abuse a pistol red dot takes far outweighs what it's probably going to take on an AK or even a shotgun, if you think about the force applied to that. So that first RMR, that's going to be my number one choice. The second one will be okay, much more affordable. The third one I'm going to recommend is the Leupold Delta Point. The Leupold Delta Point, although not a tube, it has a very big window for a pistol optic, probably getting on the size of a 30mm tube. It's got a big window. And it's Leupold Delta Point. It's got military contracts. It's rugged. It's reliable. It's made in America, as is a Trijicon RMR. But either one of those, but if you mentioned specifically you wanted a big tube, that's going to have a bigger field of view than the RMR. And I think those are going to be your best bets because, again, the AK, especially a gas block mount, is going to get hot if you're shooting fast and dirty. And the AK, although a great system, is not known for being overly gentle. And not for you, since you already have your AK and you like it, but I'm just throwing this out there. There's a time when you could get decent, you know, surplus AKs, you know, the fall of the Cold War. You could get good Russian and Chinese and stuff imports. Those days are kind of gone. Right now, decent AKs are, you know, $1,000 or more. You might really consider, for everybody else out there, if you're looking at this, you know, 7.62x39 that can mount a good optic without a bunch of workarounds, look at the Ruger Mini 30. Now, I did use Mini 14s in police work. I liked them. There are certain times when I would like an AR. There are certain times when I would like a Mini 14. It's a fine system. Mini 30 is the Mini 14 that shoots 7.62x39, and it not only can mount optics well, it comes with really good scope mounts right out of the box. It comes in stainless steel if you want it. Get a wood stock, you can get a polymer stock, and they're not cheap, but for what a good AK costs, you can get a good Ruger Mini 30 with a good optics mounting system. So I'm just throwing that out there for everybody else. Hey, thanks TSP, I appreciate you guys and your questions. Thanks Jack, have a blessed day.
I'm glad he did all that. And it sounds like from the beginning he sort of agrees with me this is not the best approach. I'm just going to simply state that I just kind of feel like the AK is from an era where a lot of the things that we use today in the gun world just didn't exist. And they weren't considered important in a combat scenario that was common for the time. Heavy force-on-force engagement was what these weapons were being built for. Remember, these were built leading into the Second World War and in during the Second World War, where the mindset was the war from the 19-teens, World War I, with giant masses of troops just shooting at each other. Right? There was not a lot of house-to-house urban combat in World War I. There ended up being quite a bit of it in World War II, but it was not the plan ever. It was never thought of. So that's where those types of optics really shine, is those close quarters combat. You don't want a scope. You want improvement over iron sights. The gun was just not made at a time where that was even a consideration into its design. Also being a Russian design, Russian designs have always been, but certainly at this time, incredibly utilitarian. This is just not, these two worlds don't go together, in my opinion. The AK is a perfectly awesome weapon the way that it is, and I just wouldn't. But you can do what you want, and Mike gave you some good answers. I almost made a mistake here, too, guys. I almost glossed over Matt Sersley's segment on taxes and business meals. So let's listen to that, and then I'll come back and do my segment for you today.
Hey, TSP crew. This is Matthew Sersley with AgrisTaxAdvice.com, here to talk about how to deduct your business meals. I see this question all the time online. I get emails with it. Can I deduct my lunch when I'm with the client? How about when I'm traveling? What about a meal with my business partner? Can I write off all my meals? Because I have to be able to live to do work in my business. Let's clear all of this up. And also be aware that when you're looking online or with ChatGPT, there's a lot of bad information because the rules were one way, then they changed a little bit for COVID, and then they went back. And so it's really easy to find information from a time period where these rules were very different. First of all, just like all other business deductions, you have to follow the base rule. It has to be ordinary and necessary in your trade or business. It should be directly related to a business activity. Now, thankfully in this case, necessary doesn't mean necessary. Necessary really means, does it help you make money? Does it help you avoid losing money? Does it help you do your marketing or any of that sort of thing? Anything like that is considered necessary. Now, the ordinary part of this does matter. They are going to look at both overall what you're spending on meals, but they may look at individual meals compared to your profit. And if those prices are excessive, they may not allow them. So try to avoid the $500 night out as a business meal in a business that's making even $200,000 a year, unless you have a really good reason for it. If you have a good reason, that's great. You know, everything is relative. Personal meals, like your daily lunch, not deductible. In fact, unless you are traveling, you can pretty much never deduct any meals that you eat by yourself. Business meals must include active business discussions during the meal or must involve business travel. You can't just go out to dinner with your business partner and not talk about business and write it off. But the whole discussion does not have to be about business. 10 minutes in a 60-minute meal is totally acceptable. Now, the vast majority of business meals are not fully deductible. We call them 50% deductible instead of 100% deductible. The vast majority of meals you deal with, in many of my clients' cases, in fact, all of the meals they deal with, are 50% deductible. So any client lunches or dinners, any meals with your business partners, any meals while traveling for work are going to be 50% deductible. Now, you're going to find a lot of places that say it's 100% deductible. It was for 2 years because of COVID, and they're trying to encourage people to go out to eat. Currently, and who knows, because there are changes coming with the new tax bill, but currently, these are all 50% deductible. When are meals 100% deductible? Well, there's three major times. The first is office parties and company picnics for employees. So if you do a Christmas party or a summer picnic party and you invite all of your employees, that's going to be deductible. Don't do this if your family business is just inviting your family and you're having a Christmas party for your family. Certain people do not count as employees for this purpose. And a majority of people who come to the party need to be employees or their family or spouses. Now, also another 100% deductible case is meals provided to the general public. So if you're doing some sort of an open house or a promotional event and you're providing food, that's all 100% deductible. Finally, there are limited scenarios, and this is a hard burden to meet, where meals for employees can be 100% deductible if they are provided for the benefit of the employer. The standard case for this is you have an employee and you suddenly realize something's not going to get done during the business day. And you say, hey, stay late and I will buy you your meal. I'll order takeout, whatever. Then it's 100% deductible. But no, you can't do this every day. This technically applies to owners, but it's often disallowed for owners if you don't have a really good reason for it. So this is not something you should be doing super regularly. Now, there is one last time it's 100% deductible for the business, and that's when you actually include it as income on the employee's W-2. And this does have to be an employee. It doesn't apply for a 1099 contractor. I have never had a client where this has come up because employees get pissed if you pay for meals for them and then they pay taxes on it. You know, also just in general, if you're the employee, this has nothing to benefit you. And there are rules for you. If you expense meals to employees as part of their W-2 income, you have to do that for all of the employees. So you can't take advantage of some of these deductions for yourself. I don't like that, but just to be complete, wanted to go over it. Now, traveling is a place where you can really take advantage of this sometimes. And that's because you could use your actual receipts or you could use the per diem rates for wherever you're traveling. And in many places across the country, that's $60, $70, $80 per day. And then you just write off that per diem amount. Now, the first day and the last day, you do less. There's some other rules you need to jump through for this. But it's really great for most of us, if we're being frugal, if we're not spending tons of money going out to eat, if we're not getting breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day, your per diem rate is likely to be higher, in some cases considerably higher, than your actual receipts. Per diem's also great if you're doing a trip that's a business trip, but maybe you're taking your kids with you and they're not part of the business. And if you're cooking, it gets really hard to calculate what the actual receipts are. But if you're doing per diem, you just do per diem. So per diem is really, really great because it often will let you save more money and you can get away with a little bit less record keeping. Now, you do need to decide for any particular trip whether you're doing per diem or actual expenses, but you can change trip to trip. And in fact, every employee can make their own determination. But if you as a company allow anybody to use per diem, you have to let everybody use per diem. If you allow anybody to use actual receipts, you have to allow everybody to use actual receipts. Now, you can have rules for actual receipts of no more than X dollars. So you're not going to be on the hook if your employee goes out and spends a $500 on a meal. But this is an important thing that everybody gets to pick their own way of how they submit it to their employer. Now, another great way to use this is meals with a business partner. This is particularly useful if your business partner is maybe your spouse. Well, just like most meals, these meals are deductible at 50% as long as there's a business purpose for it, like discussing, I don't know, your quarterly numbers, the marketing plan you're getting ready to do, how the contractor is working out. Should you hire somebody else? Should you get rid of an employee? Again, just like with every other meal, it does not have to be 100% business. A good rule of thumb is 15% of the time is plenty. Now, meals need to be documented, and really documented better than many other expenses, because the IRS wants to make sure you're just not writing off a bunch of meals. The IRS requires you to document the date, the amount of money, if you're not doing per diem, who is present, and the business purpose. That business purpose should not be discussing the business. That business purpose should be 2, 3, maybe 4, 5, 6 sentences long, maybe longer if it's a particularly expensive meal. Now, technically, the IRS does not require receipts for meals under $75. Keep the receipt anyway. It won't hurt to have it. In fact, keep the receipt even if you're planning on using per diem. First of all, you can decide after the trip if it's a trip. So, you know, keep all the receipts in case they happen to be higher. But why would you destroy any documentation showing that this was a business purpose, keeping track of everything? So keep the receipts. I use QuickBooks Online. I use the app. The app's great. I take a photo of the receipt. It saves it. There's a place for making notes. All the notes I need to make get made there. And that way it's saved forever. So to recap, first of all, no, you can't just write off all your meals. Secondly, most of your meals are 50% deductible, which, you know, it sucks it's not 100%, but it's better than it's zero. If you can find a 100% meal deduction that saves you money, great. Take advantage of it. Per diem is really great. I love per diem. When you're traveling, this is a fantastic way to save money on your taxes. If you are not documenting meals, if you are not taking meals that you are otherwise able to write off, you are wasting money. Well, thanks so much. Please reach out to me at agoristtaxadvice.com/ESP. You'll get a free report on business deductions like meals. You'll also get a chance to schedule a free phone call with me. Have a great week. Go save money.
I just want to give you kind of a really great way to keep track of this and other expenses that are routine that happen a lot. What it makes a good idea to do is just make yourself a template, a simple Word document that has something like location of meal, people present at meal, what was discussed at meal, and have that ready and print out several copies of that. Get yourself a package of manila envelopes that are designed to fit 8 by 8.5 by 11 standard paper, because no matter what the receipt is, you're probably stapling it to one of those. When you're out and about and doing your thing, make enough notes on that receipt immediately that you will have a memory jogger that when you get home, and this is something you need to do daily or at least weekly, get on your piece of paper, right? And you can leave it on your computer and type it in, or you can handwrite it and have them print it out. It's up to you how you want to do it. And put that down. And I agree, you know, at least a couple, three sentences about what you discussed. Don't just put discussed upcoming event. Discussed menu with head chef. Like this one I just did. Discussed menu with head chef and other staff member for upcoming November workshop for estimated 100 students at YMCA Camp Carter. Went over menu options, menu ideas, workflow for kitchen staff, and how many staff are actually needed. That's pretty airtight. And that really was what we did. So I had Michael and Teresa, and Michael's always our head chef. They met us at Camp Carter. Actually, they came here, then we went to Camp Carter, so I left my office, so that's mileage. Then we went to have lunch after we toured the facility. They saw the kitchen, understood its capabilities. I've got videos of that. Like, if you want to audit me on that one, guys, good luck, right? And remember that no one's, like, recording you when you do this, so it's important that you just put together what sounds reasonable. As far as the 50% deduction, that's fine. It doesn't bother me at all. I would never make a meal for my employee a form of compensation. But I will tell you where that came from. There were companies, and this is what they were doing to game the system. They were, let's say, every Thursday bringing in lunch for people in the break room, and it was consistently every Thursday. And we were doing, the reason I know this, we were doing some stuff like this at one of my companies a long time ago. And our CFO came in and she was like, you can't keep doing this. You're going to get audited. It's too consistent. It's the same time every time. And basically that is, if you're going to do that, then it has to become a form of compensation. Like you come up with a value, you divide up all your employees that are, and then you come up with a number, and that would just piss people off. I would be mad if somebody did that to me. I don't benefit from that in any way. I'd rather have the money. I'll go get my own food. Thank you. All right, moving on, though. Okay, the other thing is on those envelopes, you need at least 12 of them. Put 1, 2, 3, all the way to 12. And all your receipts for every month go in that envelope. Even if you don't do a sheet with it, it'll be a hell of a lot more organized when you go to enter it if you let things slip, because we do, right? Entrepreneurs do that. All right, let's talk about what I want to talk about to you guys today. I really get frustrated with the defeatist language that I hear mostly from the youth today. And what I'm calling my segment is why we have to change our entire mindset from what should be to what's going to be. So I see two versions of this. People in my age bracket, maybe 10 years younger, 10 years older, what they're focused on is how fucked up the government is, how wrong it is, how economically screwed we are, how we should be doing this and we should be doing that, and Trump promised this, but he's doing that, and they were going to cut spending. Here's the thing. It doesn't matter. They were never going to cut spending in any meaningful way. It was never going to happen. It was all a wonderful fiction, and you should have known that as a grown-ass adult. Okay? But because of the structuring of the way things are going forward, there is a tremendous amount of flux and shift, and that is opportunity in society. The problem for people our age is we only have so long to capitalize on it, and our energy level is not what it was when we were 25. Now, rewind over to the 25 to 30-year-old, right? Now, these are the people that are bitching constantly that they don't have any money, they're totally broke, and there's no opportunity for them because we took it all from them because we have money and they don't. They don't understand, I think, a lot of times that when we were 25, we were also fucking broke. Okay, we were also broke. When we were a 28-year-old guy with a freaking 7-year-old son, we were broke too. And we had to do shit that we didn't want to do to get unbroke. You know, I don't want to go into a whole bunch about me, but I mean, in my case, I ended up having to shift careers multiple times. I ended up having to be on the road for a whole portion of my life. While my son was growing up, 3 weeks a month, 4 days a week, I was gone. I didn't like it, but it's what it took to advance my career. You do what you have to when you're young so that you don't have to keep doing it when you're old. And if all you do is bitch when you're young, when you get old, you'll have the same amount of broke-ass bullshit. Okay? And well, the way I like to sum this up, this is what I've come up with recently. The guys that are veterans here, you've been around a long time, you'll know I've used this term a long time, and that's microwave thinking. But I kind of, with this whole thing going on, I realize one of the problems that the young people I'm trying to reach in this audience have is they think they can't succeed because, well, I can only save $5 a day in Bitcoin. Or I can only do this one side gig thing and I only can make $100 a week off of it. And they look at it and they go, that's not going to get me ahead. It's a freaking start. And it's amazing what happens when somebody goes from zero to one. When you get off the fucking X and you get your ass moving, it's amazing when you figure out what you can do next. So here's the way I'm going to explain this to you. Microwave thinking versus smoking a brisket. Okay? This is old school Jack Spirko here, guys. But remember, when I started this show, I was 36. Just to clue you in, like, and it wasn't easy. And I had everything I wanted, and I still wanted more, so I built something from nothing. But this is how you have to think about it to do it. One of the biggest reasons young people think they can't win right now is time. Not the lack of it, the expectation of instant results. I've called it microwave thinking for years, and anyone under 55 probably grew up with a microwave if you're from the United States. You toss in your food, press a button, and boom, hot meal in a minute. It's a great tool for reheating leftovers, but real cooking, no chance. It doesn't work. Now compare that to smoking a brisket. You don't microwave a brisket. You prep it, you season it, you get it to temps right, and then it's hours of low and slow. You don't walk away, you don't rush it, you don't crank the heat because you're impatient. But here's the key part. After an hour or two, it still looks raw. It doesn't look like anything's happening, but it is. Under the surface, the transformation is happening. You just can't see it yet. That's how building wealth works. That's how building anything real works. Business, skills, freedom, all of it. It's all the same. Everyone wants to pop in an idea, push a button, and see results. It doesn't work like that. Not in the real world. Not with things that last. It's fiat thinking, microwave thinking. If you try to microwave a brisket, you ruin it. If you try to shortcut your path to success, same thing. You dry it out, burn it up, and you waste the potential. This moment in time, it's full of opportunity. More than I ever had in my 20s. I know some of you don't believe that, but I'm about to prove it to you. Because I'm going to give you a list of things that you can do that when I was in my 20s, not only couldn't I do, they didn't exist. Nobody could do them. No one had an opportunity to do anything I'm about to give you. But it still takes the same process that I used. That's why I wrote the book that I did. The tools are faster, though. The reach is bigger. The fundamentals of success haven't changed. They're the same as in my book. They're the same as in the classic book from George Clausen, you know, The Richest Man in Babylon, that was written in the 1920s. It's all the same. But again, you can't microwave the brisket. You can't microwave results. You got to settle in for the slow cook, and it's worth it. What do you have today that we just didn't have when I was in my 20s or even early 30s? Well, first of all, you have Bitcoin. I know some of you are tired of hearing about it, but it is the number one hard asset on planet Earth right now. And its future is a telegraphed punch that if you can't see it coming, you've closed your eyes and you don't want to. I had somebody yesterday tell me, all I'm able to do right now is I buy $10 worth of Bitcoin a day. And I said to that person, and years from now, somebody will tell you that you're lucky that you did. But it's not luck. It was a choice. You had to find the $70 a week somewhere to make that happen. You have access to a permissionless, decentralized, wealth-building tool not available to the average person 20 years ago in any form. Don't tell me about gold. Gold has been suck-ass compared to Bitcoin since... Gold has not done as well as Bitcoin. If you give gold from 1980 till today, and Bitcoin from 2008 till today. Okay? So it's there was nothing you could do this with. Not to mention it doesn't move across space and time. It's not fully decentralized. It's not fractional down to an infinite level. Bitcoin is changing economics in the world, and some of you are sitting there staring at it, refusing to do anything with it, because frankly, you're still bitter that you haven't for the last 10 years. Stop being bitter and start being proactive. How about AI as a force multiplier? Not only did we not have that when I was in my 20s, we didn't have it 5 years ago. I mean, I was building a company in the early 2000s with Neil Franklin where we were using AI, but we didn't have what we have now accessible to everyone. From marketing to product development, if you are a solopreneur, it lets you do what it used to take entire teams to do. I'm telling you, that's part of why I put the course together that went on sale today. The workload that you can get done as a single person in an hour a day developing just a marketing plan for a business over a month or two, that used to take tens of thousands of dollars and a half a dozen professionals to get done. You have that. Plus, you can use it for learning and everything else that goes along with it. How about the instant gig economy? DoorDash, Uber. Yeah, I can't do that. My car's not new enough. How about like TaskRabbit, right? You can make money this week that you wouldn't have otherwise if you want to, and if you'll take the steps and you'll get it done. Like, here's a list of some of these sites that you can start making money on like immediately without like super, you know, giant requirements for like you have to have an escalator or something. Rover, which is pet sitting and dog walking, boarding, like Airbnb meets Uber for dogs. Thumbtack, that's like plumbers, tutors, handyman, etc., customers needing services. TaskRabbit, odd jobs, like furniture assembly, moving, house cleaning, and errands. Fiverr, I mean, most of you probably know that, but offer digital service, design, writing, video, etc., starting at $5 a gig. You can use freaking AI to do the work for somebody else who's too lazy or doesn't have the time to use AI to do it. Upwork, which is freelance work in areas like writing, coding, admin, and marketing. Bunny Studio, that's voice work, audio editing, translation gigs, especially for people who are creative. Wag, that's similar to Rover, but it's more of an on-demand dog walking service. So instead of pet sitting, it's just going by, getting the dog, taking it for a walk, putting him back. Are you freaking kidding me? You have that and you're going to tell me you can't make extra money? Toro, rent out your personal car like Airbnb for vehicles. Not for everybody, but for some of you. If you have a car that sits more than it drives, you could have monetized it by now. Neighbor, rent out storage space in your home, garage, shed, or others. If you have a great big empty-ass garage, you know you people will pay you to store shit in it. And then bellhop, moving help. You unload and load trucks, pack boxes. It's like basically being a helper for like a U-Haul type service. Now, there's actually more. There's about 70 that are legit, and they're in markets large enough that when I say you can make money this week, you can make money this week, next week at the latest. I compiled a list of the top 50 best ones for you. It's in today's show notes. If you go and you see my segment right underneath it, you'll see my presenter notes that I used today. You can download those if you want to. And you'll also see a second link, top 50 gig economy websites. So don't give me shit about you can't make more money. I say you're not applying yourself, because if you wanted more money, there it is. How about the creator economy in the long game? YouTube, podcasts, newsletters, build once, earn forever. It takes time, but the upside is huge. You want me to, somebody, sometimes when I say this, do you eat your own dog food, Jack? Do you do what you say? That's exactly what I did, isn't it? Don't I make my entire living off the creator economy? And I did it at a time it was a lot harder. All the tools you have, all the momentum, all the acceptance. When I started and somebody said, well, what do you do? And I said, I'm a podcaster. I had to tell them what a podcast was. Today, there's podcasts everywhere. There's video content everywhere. It's an accepted form of professionalism today. You are being sought out by corporations today. The gatekeepers aren't gone. The gatekeepers have opened the fucking door to creators. I just got a $600 piece of equipment from a company I didn't even ask for. I was just trying to get them on the show for an interview. I'll tell you about it later. There's no gatekeeping anymore. And there's so many small companies, they don't even have gatekeepers. All you have to do is send them an email and say, hey, I want to work with you. And you're going to get told no like 5 out of 10 times. Send 100 fucking emails, you get 50 yeses. And guess what? AI will write the damn emails for you. Customized to each individual one. A short and long version. Hit them with the short version first. You don't hear back, hit them with the long version. This is minutes a day to build a creator economy long game. Remote work and geo-arbitrage. Do you know, there's websites that specialize, in fact, they're in my, there's a couple of them on my list for you in the gig economy. They specialize in remote work. Once you have a remote job, you can live anywhere. You can create arbitrage by living in Nebraska, or you can get create arbitrage by living in Croatia if you're young and mobile. And the person right now is going, I can't move. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to hear your shit. I gave you like four other things already you could have done instead of that if you don't want to do that. And I ain't done yet. Starting a business is frictionless now. You can set up an LLC in seconds online. I don't think you should without talking to an attorney first to see if it's even the right step for you. You should have a business that has flow of cash on some level before you bother with an LLC or an S Corp or whatever. But it's doable. You can set up a Stripe account in minutes to start taking credit card payments or do it with something like PayPal. Shopify, drop shipping, digital products, launch in hours, not months, if you really come up with a product and you know what you want to do. How about world-class free education? How do you think I learned all the shit that I learned? A lot of it, it's just the way of thinking about business. I learned by buying cassette tapes, driving around in my car when I was working and listening to them until I wore them the hell out, then taking them to Half Price Books, begging them for some money, and getting another set. And you have the internet, you have YouTube, you have courses you can buy for a few bucks, you have courses that are free. There's literally companies that will charge you a significant couple thousand bucks for a coding camp with no experience and guarantee you at the end of that you will have a job offer. The amount of education you can get today. The amount of education you can get if you really learn to use something like ChatGPT or any of the other things. And you keep, when you don't know how to do something, ask the damn tool how to do it and it'll tell you. Whatever you want to do, there's probably some 18-year-old kid that made a video of exactly how to do it on YouTube. And you're telling me I can't. And every one of you that says that, I'll just ask you, how many hours a week do you watch TV or play video games or sit on the couch and stare at the wall or stare at your phone or post shit on Twitter or whatever else it is? I see you on X Twitter all the time. Yeah, and I'm making money with it. I'm not bitching just a bitch. I have an agenda. Maybe you should too. No code and low code tech. This is one of the coolest things because once you develop it, if you can sell it, it's a money printer. And let's say it's a little money printer. It only prints you $100 a month. Well, you don't get excited about $100 a month, but $100 a month invested into your long-term retirement can change your life forever. But let's see, what would get you excited? Would $1,000 a month get you excited? Oh, okay. Well, if you can build one that nets you $100 a month in profit, not gross, just nets, after expenses, then can't you build 10? And once you build 10, don't the 10 become stronger than the one by itself, especially if you do it systematically so they all intertwine? And then you could develop a whole series of marketing and lead magnets and lead generation tools and take all 10 of them and you could interact with them and upsell, cross-sell, and bundle. I don't know how to do that. Guess what ChatGPT does? I was like, well, this whole idea of low-tech app launching, automated workflows, you know, I really don't understand what that means when I was doing my research for today's show. So I talked to ChatGPT about it, and I'm like, yeah, you know what? That's that. I get it now. Basically, what you know, my problem with apps for app development is it's gotten very expensive to get in, like, the Apple App Store. Like, you have to pay Apple a lot of money just to let you in the door. But we have these web apps that basically the person makes an icon, saves it to their phone, and now they have the app. There's no approval process, no nothing. I'm like, oh, okay, I get that. And some other things. And some like there are sites like Glide that will actually help you build this with no coding. You just know what you want, make a spreadsheet. Fucking GPT can help you make the spreadsheet. Collect the data, assemble it. So I was like, you know what, just pick a random idea and walk me through what that would look like. Because I don't know. I don't have all the answers, but I know who does, so I'm going to ask. Step-by-step guide. How to build it with no code. The idea, a web app that helps parents plan weekly meals with easy recipes, auto-generates a shopping list, optionally suggests prep tips, nothing crazy, just practical and helpful. Choose a tool. Use Glide. It's built off Google Sheets and super intuitive. Create a spreadsheet. Set up a Google Sheet with tabs like meals, name, ingredients, instructions, days of week, shopping list, auto-populated. Import to Glide. Connect to spreadsheet to Glide. It instantly turns your data into a working app. Design your screens. Home weekly view with 7 days. Tap a day, pick a meal from your list. Auto-generate grocery list from selected meals. Add logic. Glide leads you through basic actions. When a meal is selected, add its ingredients to shopping list tab. If a day is empty, show pick a meal button. Yeah? Brand it. Upload a logo. Change the colors. Name it to something like Quick Plan. Meals made easy. Test it on your phone. If it works like a native app, send yourself a link and add it to your home screen. 8. Monetize. Offer free version, 3 meals a week. Paid plan unlocks full recipes, bonus content, community access. You strive for payments inside Glide Launch. Share link in Mom Group on Facebook, TikTok, wherever your market is, you're live. Now, I want you to take that a little bit further, and I want you to think about it. If you own a business already or you have an idea for a business, I don't know that that would be a great app unless you already had a business that was based on fitness, nutrition, health, or time management or something, mommy blog, like something in that space, then it would fit. If you were Chef Ken Daniels, you might develop an app like that specifically designed to help people live a low-carb lifestyle. But if you were a business that did something completely different, you might develop an app like that for your particular business, your particular niche, which I don't know. It's up to you to build it. Think about the fact that you can do that, and then GPT can help you create an entire sales funnel for it, an entire marketing plan for it, develop adjunctive products that go with it, and again, bundle, cross, upsell, and downsell. Again, you don't know those words? Go ask. It'll give you the answers. Next, crowdfunding and direct patronage. You can raise capital on Kickstarter. Let your audience support you on Patreon. No bank or publisher needed. I think those platforms have limits, but they're really great for some things. You have an idea for a product, you can make a prototype, but you don't have the money to fund the development of the product fully and roll it out. You have that option today. That is something that it's been around about 10-ish years now, but it did not exist 20 years ago. In fact, if you had asked the government if they would let you build it 20 years ago, they would have told you no. So much of this technology we have is disruptive in that it so defied the system. The system didn't want it, but it was so powerful that people just did it, and there was nothing the system could do about it. This is the opportunity in front of you today. You have a convergence of disruption. Do you understand that? You have Bitcoin. I know it gets tiresome for some of you to hear it, but you need to hear it till it's not tiresome anymore. Disrupting the entire monetary system of the planet. You have companies coming out now that are specifically going to exist to use Bitcoin as leverage for financial services. And those are, I'm in the gold standard back. That's what gold was during the gold standard, you doorknob. Okay? You have countries buying and stacking Bitcoin. Pakistan just got a whole bunch of money from the United Kingdom, fiat, printed pounds, as aid. And you know what they're going to do? They're going to start a Bitcoin reserve. Michael Saylor said the first country to print fiat to buy Bitcoin wins. Maybe the first country to use printed fiat that's other people's money to buy Bitcoin wins. I don't know. But you have all this happen. You have companies dropping like 21 Capital. You have more and more Bitcoin treasury companies. You got the United States government saying we're going to have a strategic reserve. You have a Bitcoin bill on the floor sponsored by a moderate Republican that has friends on the Democrat side that already was able to sell the Genius Act to bring stable coins in. And you're sitting there staring at going, I can only buy $10 a day. I can only buy $5 a day. I can only buy $15 a week. But are you? Are you doing that? Yeah, I don't know what to do. I don't have any money. I'm barely getting by. What's holding you back? This is what I told a guy that I mentioned earlier today on X. Write down all the excuses for your inaction or what you think of as reasons, because they're excuses. But if you need to call them reasons, to write them down. I want you to write down, you know, I need to spend time with my kids or whatever it is. I want you to just be like, go ahead and dump all your emotion, like you're talking to a therapist. I can't do what Jack says because blah, 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 blah. I want you to write it down. Type it, handwrite it, I don't care what you do. Then I want you to take that piece of paper and I want you to put it away. And at any point, or that file and save it, and at every point during the next couple days, if another excuse, another reason, another, this is why I can't comes up. I want you to add it to the list. And then I want you to just put it away and forget about it. Set a reminder on your calendar or whatever for like 48 hours. That way you'll emotionally separate from it. Then I want you to pick it up, and I want you to do a mental experiment for me. I want you to imagine that you have a friend telling you, I can't get ahead, it's too hard, blah, 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 poor me, whatever it is, right? You got somebody telling you, I can't succeed today because the boomers took it all, whatever it is, and it's not you that wrote those things. I want you to then act like you're their best friend in the world and you want success for them. And I want you to read those excuses and think of what your response would be to a person saying that to you if it wasn't you. Then go look in the mirror. And when you say something like, I need to spend more time with, I want you to replace it with, in order to spend more time with, I need to do better so that I can. And I need to do better at what? What is it? If you really are so stretched right now that all you can do is save a few bucks in Bitcoin a day, do that. That's step one. There's a funny thing about steps. A person that thinks they can't move, they can't get off X, they can't go. A person that's sure can't move. They take one step. And I would tell you, like, if you need mental help with this, like you're just stuck on it, stand up and take one step. And a step is just the left foot goes forward, and that's a step. Tell me that the minute you do that, you don't feel the need to move that right foot forward. That's what will happen if you pick one thing to anchor on and do just that. And then remember, you're not using a microwave. You're doing the longest slow cook of your life. It's not a overnight brisket smoke. It is a lifelong parenting of your own career and your own success. That's what it really is. It is giving birth to something new. You're giving birth to someone who stops becoming just an employee who works for the man that they bitch about all the time. You're becoming an investor. You're becoming a business owner. You're becoming your own life coach. You do those things. Well, then everything starts to progress. Everything starts to change. You become far more able to take the next step. You become actually addicted to your own success. And what I want to finish with is this. I found it interesting throughout my life that almost everyone who sets on this course with actual intent has success. Not instant, not overwhelming all the time, but when a person decides, I am going to dedicate my future to making sure that I build wealth and freedom in my life, that person inevitably does better than their peers. The gap there is much stronger than the gap between, well, this group of people went to high school, and these people went to college, and these college people do so much better than these high school-only people. The real difference is, did you ever have that moment? Did you ever have that moment where you decided, this is not enough? There will be more. I will make it happen. If you haven't, the issue you have is no one can do it for you. This talk may enable you to do it for yourself, but make no mistake about it. When you write me an email and you say, Jack, you changed my life, I always respond the same way. No. I informed you. You changed your life. Only you can do it. You know that little project I gave you with the meal app and all? You know, ChatGPT can help you do it, but it can't do it. You have to gather the information. You have to make the spreadsheet. You have to link the two things together. You have to get a website. You have to pay somebody maybe to make some graphics for you. You have to do the work. You just have a team behind you. Just learn how to lead that team. And the first thing you have to do before you can lead a team, let's learn how to lead you. And every time you say, there's no opportunity for me, I can't because, or even when you are being passive aggressive against yourself, but what can I possibly do? What opportunity is there for me? You are setting your own defeat up. Don't do that. The reason I go long when I do segments like this is because I fucking care about you more than you know, and I don't even know you individually most of the time. I do. I am not a guy, if you're new to this show, I am not a guy that makes my living like Tony Robbins. Though somebody did say Jack is like Tony Robbins, except he hits you with the board instead of teaching you to break it. That's not me. I don't make my living off of rah-rah speeches. I give talks like this because I absolutely, fundamentally know that this is the course to the greatest freedom in life for the most people, and that anybody can do it. You don't need to be smart. You just need to be consistent, and you need to not quit, and you need to become informed. You can seem smart to people when you know you can. People with an IQ of 85 can do this. Honest to God, when I was young, looking at some people that were very successful in life and listening to them talk and going, really? This person? And I didn't begrudge them their success. I just thought, well, I have no excuse. So like the first time I saw Greening the Desert by Jeff Lawton, and I was bitching about how hard it was, you know? And all of a sudden, I realized if these people can do this, I can. And I made a choice. And the day I made that choice, everything changed. And I became a 20-year overnight success. That's what it takes. No microwaves. Slow and low and grind. Either you want it or you want to complain. One of my laws of life, you can make excuses or you can make money. Not both. With that, I'll wrap up. Thanks for tuning in today. Have a great weekend. I'll have a flashback for you tomorrow. We'll do this all again on Monday. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.